Gary Okihiro is my name. I'm a professor of international and public affairs here at Columbia University, and I also direct the Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. The receiver needs to be placed closer to me. Yeah? Okay. Sarah's hand holding this thing, her arms is gonna get, arms gonna get heavy. Yeah, she has a huge bicep, I can see that. Yeah, okay. Without humor, all right. Gary Okihiro, Professor of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University, and oh dear. All right. Yes, okay. Sure. I'm Gary Okihiro, Director of the Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race and Professor of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. Well, the Manila men are largely Filipino, but also Chinese sailors who sailed on these Spanish galleons since 1565, which traversed the Pacific Ocean between Manila and Acapulco in Mexico. Well, the Manila men were, as I said, sailors on board these ships, and that's a very interesting story because European sailors oftentimes died literally in the tropical zone because of diseases and also vitamin deficiencies. So,
the beeping. Often died in the tropical zone.
Often died in the tropical zone because of susceptibility to tropical diseases and also not having the proper nutrition, mainly vitamins and minerals, which their bodies needed. So many of the European ships, not only the Spanish ships, but also Dutch and British ships, employed native sailors to largely man their ships. But Filipino Manila men were also very important because they knew shipping technology. I mean, they knew the hardwoods in the Philippines that could be used to construct these galleons, and also they knew the waters because the waters were treacherous around the Philippines, which has thousands of islands, of course. So they were used both as navigators and sailors, and also as shipbuilders. Voluntary. Many of the Manila men were probably voluntary, although it was typical for European sailors or crews to kidnap or use through deception, capture many of the sailors. And thus, not only because of how they were recruited, but also because of the conditions of work, which were oftentimes laborious, and these were exceedingly long voyages, that many of these Manila men jumped ship whenever it reached port, whether it was in Guam or in Mexico. Well, sailing in these days, we're talking about the 16th century, or as early as the 16th century, was always a difficult occupation. It wasn't a very pleasant trip. If one looked at the construction of the ship, one's crews were usually way in the hold of the ship, and very tight quarters, unsanitary, and food was oftentimes quite bland and also not very nutritious because fresh vegetables and fruits were not available, of course, on long voyages. So the conditions were difficult that way. Also, the labor itself was oftentimes, sometimes tedious, but then when busy, it was exceedingly taxing. So Many of these sailors had incentives to not only, by the way, Manila men, but also European sailors had great incentives to run away from these ships. Yeah, in fact, it was typical, I would say, you know, throughout the South Pacific, wherever these ships landed, many of the crew ran away, and so ship captains would have to commandeer, which is a very gentle term, actually kidnap a lot of workers to man their ships just because they needed those bodies. So yes, upon arrival in a place like Acapulco, I would suspect that a good number or percentage of the crew actually ran away from the ship and settled in areas to the interior of Mexico. Not at all. I mean, the Manila men were not exemplary of the typical immigrant story because the immigrant story within the U.S. Narrative is one of necessity and extravagance. That is, necessity oftentimes pushed migrants out of their home country, and extravagance meant opportunities which attracted them to the New World. These opportunities were frequently...
You want to start with opportunities that attracted them
okay.
to the New World?
Okay. All right. Sorry, Nick, we're recording live here. Yeah, okay.
Okay.
All right, so the typical migrant story was one of necessities and also opportunities. And that's the typical narrative within U.S. history. Now, many, well, actually a few historians, including myself, have seen Asian migration to the Americas not in those terms, but more analogous to the African slave trade. That is, that many of these early migrants were in fact lured, if not forced, on board ships and deployed as labor. And those labor then were transported to the New World because of the necessities, whether on European ships or on European plantations in the New World. So the Manila men, thus, were not seeking to come to America, you see. The Spaniards went to the Philippines in the first instance, got their labor and goods from the Philippines and China and so forth, and used their labor to transport these goods, which enriched them and the Spanish Empire, beginning, as I said, since 1565. Well, what was happening in the world was that Europe was seeking Asia. Europe was seeking the East. And if one will recall, in the late 15th century, just before the Manila galleon trade, various European countries sought routes to Asia, India, China. And so one group, headed by the Portuguese, went down the coast of Africa and rounded the Cape of Good Hope and went into the Indian Ocean that way. The other group, headed by Spain, headed westward, and that's where Columbus bumped into the Americas. And so the Spanish Empire was built on the premise of searching for Asia. In fact, Columbus died thinking that he had discovered Asia. Even on his fourth voyage, he thought he was nearing Asia. But in any case, and that's why Indians were called Indians, by the way, obviously. So anyway, so when the Spaniards then, in the case of Balboa, who crossed the Panama Isthmus and saw the Pacific Ocean and named it the South Seas, and then when Magellan sailed around South America into the Pacific and into to the Philippines, where he named it in honor of King Philip II, who sent him, of course, that is the connection. So the Spanish presence in the Americas, their empire in Mexico, their presence in the Philippines was predicated on this European period of so-called exploration. In fact, they were voyages of exploitation and not so much exploration. So what they wanted then were the goods and wealth of Asia, and that's how these Asians came to the New World. Yeah, okay. You asked about the big picture, and the big picture is this, right? That Europeans were seeking routes toward Asia. And why were they seeking these routes toward Asia? Well, first of all, because the Muslims controlled the land routes across Asia Minor and West Asia, so they needed to circumnavigate that Muslim control. What kinds of goods were they seeking? This was a period of mercantilism in which city-states in Italy and also fledgling countries like Spain and Portugal and later England and ne the Netherlands launched voyages to gather things, items like spices, silks, furniture, ceramics, those kinds of ware, which they then traded, which is the mercantile basis of an economy, traded those goods for other material objects that they could not produce and thereby enrich themselves. But of course, also the wealthy merchants consumed a lot of those manufactured products. So, yes, broadly, these were manufactured goods in Asia as opposed to raw materials, which was quite different and distinctive. Under mercantilism, you see, one enriches oneself through trade. So trade means you get objects that people desire at a cheap rate, and they sell it for other objects or things like bullion, meaning gold or silver, for higher profits. And thus, one with the profit margin gains. Now, this is actually absolutely critical because Europe was quite poor and Asia was actually quite rich, specifically India and China at this time. And both of them did not want those poorly manufactured European products. So the Europeans, especially the Spaniards, found important their colony in the New World, in Mexico and in Peru, for silver and for the gold of these regions, which they then took as specie and sold it or exchanged it for these polished goods produced in Asia. Absolutely. It's key to the growth of the Spanish Empire. Well, globalization today has many different meanings, and in fact, it's so fraught with meanings that it loses its precision. But if we mean by globalization a creation of a network, which is conceived as centers and peripheries that are linked in an overall system of exchanges of labor and goods, then yes, this is the kind of beginnings of globalization. The impact of these European voyages were immense, both for Europe and the rest of the world, because what it did for Europe, of course, was it brought products and laborers toward the centers, and thus enriched European countries. Meanwhile, that enrichment was accompanied by the impoverishment of those other countries from which they drew their silver and gold and so forth. But Europeans also exported at first unconsciously and perhaps later consciously certain kinds of diseases which had devastating, horrific effects on native populations in the Americas, surely, but also in many of the islands of the Pacific. And those decimations, along with the kind of warfare that was carried out for rapacious ends and also for conquest of land and so forth, had great impact upon those local societies. So we're talking about a reciprocal, the development of the center and the underdevelopment or the impoverishment of the peripheries. If we're talking about the mid to late 16th century, of course, the North America was not yet settled. Wait a minute. Yeah, just about. And we're talking about mainly Spanish colonizations in the Caribbean basin, principally in Florida, Louisiana, Mexico, Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the various islands there, and then the northern littoral of South America. Of course, it meant also conquests of the Aztecs in Mexico and also the Incas in Peru, principally for that. And the expansion, thus, of the Spanish Empire was from the center, meaning the Caribbean basin, northward into North America and southward into South America, except for Brazil, which was a Portuguese colony. So America was principally indigenous peoples with the conquistadores expanding their empire. Dear, oh dear. My arm is getting sore here, by the way. This is an awkward situation. Okay, anyway, let's see. What's happening in the late 16th century is the expansion of the Spanish Empire around the Caribbean basin, beginning with that, and then expanding gradually northward into North America and southward into South America. Well, the Manila Men are really vital to reformulating and rethinking our ideas about Asians in the Americas broadly, because the general idea is that Asians came to America. Now, this idea is just the opposite. That is that Europeans went to Asia. And that's a very important concept because, you see, if Asians came to America, the implication was that Asians were immigrants just like other immigrants, and unlike other immigrants, perhaps, Asians came to exploit the resources of America and then return home. It's called the sojourning Asian American. So the idea, however, is just the opposite, or the reality was just the opposite. The historical reality was that Europeans went to Asia and that they brought these Asians to the Americas, not as immigrants, but as laborers. So that changes that narrative fundamentally. The other thing is that it connects Asians with Africans and the African slave trade, because the following of the Manila Men for Asians was the coolie traffic in the early 1800s, which was a replacement for the African slave trade. And these coolies, like the Manila Men, were brought on board these ships, transported across the Pacific under very bad conditions. One-third of the coolies died on some of these ships, equal to the African slavers, and they labored in the New World just like their African predecessors and also like their Manila Men predecessors. Absolutely. Absolutely. Sure. The conventional Asian American history, the conventional Asian American history begins with the gold rush in California and the specific ethnic group being the Chinese gold miners seeking Gold Mountain, of course. But that is only part of the story, that Filipinos and Chinese were in Mexico in the 16th century. And in fact, in the early 1600s, we have records of Mexican barbers complaining that Chinese barbers just outside Mexico City were lowering the rates of haircuts, and so they couldn't make money, and they wanted to drive the Chinese out of Mexico, in fact. We also have accounts, tantalizing, but accounts nonetheless, that a Filipino, if not a couple of them, were with the Spanish exploratory team that went northward and founded Los Angeles. So, you know, I think the story of the Manila Men is one of principally Filipinos, but it also includes some Chinese within that trade, and also Filipino presence in California, which was northern Mexico, after all. It wasn't part of the U.S., and also in Louisiana. Well, sort of refugees. I would say they were escaped or runaway laborers, sort of like these runaway slaves that formed these maroon communities in isolated areas. They also, that is, Filipino Manila Men, migrated from Mexico across, probably on Spanish ships, to Louisiana during a brief period when Louisiana was Spanish. And there they settled, of course, in the bayous, forming these isolated villages of Manila Men with Indians, Europeans, and other groups, mixtures, mestizo groups, which were then, you know, the foundations of Asian America, because we believe some of these communities are surely the oldest of all in North America. Definitely. Mm-hmm. Because we're talking about the mid-16th century, so they would be the earliest. There are other, well, another consideration, by the way, Ruby, is that, you know, these Filipinos settled in the American South, and our idea of Asian American history is the American West. We need to reorient and reposition our geographies, because very different histories took place in the West and in the South. The other thing is that we oftentimes, that is, in Asian American history, see the West as part of U.S. westward expansion and not as Spanish northern expansion, which we should also know was the predecessor of this westward expansion of the U.S. In any case, the South presents a very different history and very different picture of racializations and so forth, and we need to appreciate that. Oh, well, definitely. Okay, well, so if we look at California and the U.S. Southwest, we would think principally of Native peoples, but also Spanish invaders and the mixtures of people in the American West that way. We would also think about broad open spaces. We think about certain kinds of economies practiced, like minerals, gold mining, agriculture, and so forth being practiced out west. If we're thinking about the South, we would think about very different peoples, different kinds of native peoples, different landscapes, smaller scale in terms of its locality, different kind of economy being practiced. At first, I mean, for example, these were fishing villages by Manila Men, not ranches and so forth. And we would also appreciate, I think, mixed communities. I'm talking about Asian American history, like most other histories, want to view itself as exceptionalist and also as isolated. That is, we're only interested in so-called pure-type Asians and not mixtures of Asians, whether or not they would be what we might call in Hawaiian hapas and stuff. Because a lot of those early communities, in fact, were hapa communities, mixtures between Indians, Africans and Asians and Europeans. So we have, of course, accounts of Filipino Manila men sailing on to Europe and on board those ships meeting and marrying Europeans. So we have those kinds of mixed communities, which, of course, Louisiana and specifically New Orleans has a rich and deep history about that. Well, I certainly didn't do the original research on this, but I can tell you, I'll bet that there was a great deal more mixing before, like, formal marriages on the part of these communities. I'm positive that happened. I'm talking about Filipinos and native peoples, Filipinos and Africans, and mixtures of Africans and Europeans and so forth. Keeping to themselves. Well, that's an interesting idea. Because, yeah, of course there was that. And, of course, there were homosocial and homosexual relations, I'm sure, but there were also heterosexual relations. Can you hear this, Sarah?
Hmm?
Can you hear?
Her, kind of.
Well, I'm not going to use the word wave, all right? Sure. As far as we know, the Manila men were the first Asians in North America and formed the longest standing Asian American communities in North America. Well, their legacy is one of, first of all, an understanding about world history and that the movement of peoples and goods was much more common than we think of today, because we think of globalization as a modern phenomenon, but in fact, its roots reach back to the dawn of the 16th century. So there's that kind of legacy. Of course, there's also a legacy about being the first. There's also a legacy about an ethnic group. There's also descendants today who can trace their lineages back to these early pioneers. So I would say that as founding figures for Asian America, they are seminal. Well, I would hope that the listeners will envision a big world, an expansive world, a world in which peoples and goods moved and interacted, influenced one another, that there were also great deal of exploitation and oppression, but there was also a great deal of resistance and humanity in the constructions of and reconstruction of community and self and identity. Imagine these Manila men who came from probably fishing villages and as such isolated in the Philippines or in major port cities like Manila and cosmopolitan as a result, sailing across the expanse of the Pacific, which was far more enormous than any of them had traveled before, and settling in a land that was quite arid by comparison to the tropics in Mexico, and making their way northward into the arid southwest and also into more tropical areas of the Louisiana, and reforming communities which would be not expressly Filipino or Chinese, but would be Chinese American and Filipino American with all these mixtures and responses. So I find that an immense story that people, I hope our listeners, will sort of imagine and then look and read more about because of that very curious but also very human story. Oh, sure, no doubt that happened. That is that there were routes and reroutes. I mean, people probably traveled and retraveled these routes. So they knew, I'm sure, where people were. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, the main point is one of a human story, but also an American story, because we're talking about a U.S. audience, and I would hope that listeners will understand or grasp the idea that Asians are not recent immigrants, that they're not foreigners, that they're central to this narrative of this founding of the nation. I mean, imagine that, because you know, the foundation of America was discovered, in Europe's search for Asia. I mean, they weren't looking for the Americas, they were looking for Asia. And then when they finally reached Asia, they brought Asians to the Americas to, you know, what's interesting is that the Spaniards called the Filipinos Indians in the Philippines. And so those Asian Indians were transported to the New World, where they interacted with North American and American Indians, who were named for India in Asia. I mean, all of that is so mind-blowing that it really requires some careful thinking about the nation's past, its foundation, and who are central to its narrative. Is that it? My arm's dying. I thought you were going to ask things about Hawaii and Kane fires. Oh dear, oh dear. Okay. No, not at all. I mean, you know, I got this message from, I forgot her name.
Dime?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That you were going to ask me questions about Hawaii, too. Mm-hmm. Oh boy, how limited are we? Come on, talk about Hawaii, too. Aren't you curious? You know, Sarah is from Williams College. I gave her a history lesson about Williams' connection to Hawaii. No. Don't waste tape, all right? You're getting worried? Well, Sarah's here, you know. I mean, this is your opportunity. Yeah. No. I mean, actually, you could. Did you get my thing about Guam? You know that the Spaniards went to Guam, right? In the Manila traffic. I mentioned Guam, you know? That was one of the earlier Pacific Islands that they went to. And in fact, some historians think that some of these Manila galleons actually stopped in Hawaii before Captain Cook, the Brit guy, discovered so-called Hawaii. Because there was a lot of this trans-Pacific traffic, you know, under the galleon trade for hundreds of years before Captain Cook. So anyway, that's kind of interesting, but, you know, you're not interested, so let's go on. Yeah. No. I'm tired. We had enough. My ear is hurt, you know. I mean, you ever hold a phone to your ear this long? Huh? Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. But then you have an interesting conversation, you know? You don't want to listen to this boring guy talk about the past, you know? All right, so I guess I'm not going to talk about Hawaii, so Sarah will have to come back for that one. Yeah, I'm sure, yeah. Okay, all right. Just so you guys don't talk stink about me, all right? Yeah, okay. Yeah, here she is.
Hello. Why don't you start with, why don't you introduce yourself again and
Wait,
just
let
in
me
case
see
we
what the
start.
questions
All
are.
right.
Okay.
Did you have a look at the.
I don't remember that. I didn't even look at them. Okay. All right.
All right. Could you introduce yourself again, starting with I, and then tell us what you've studied about Hawaiian history, how you studied about Hawaiian history?
I'm Gary Okihiro, Director of the Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race and Professor of International and Public Affairs here at Columbia University. How I got started in the history of Hawaii began with my own background, having grown up in Hawaii and, in fact, growing up on a sugar plantation in the town of Aiea, Hawaii, or on the island of Oahu. And that sparked my initial interest in the place and also my own background.
So, what was Hawaii like before the Westerners came?
Well, Hawaii evolved over the course of several, over 1,000 years before Europeans arrived. And most scholars believe that the Hawaiians came in waves from Polynesia. At first, the Society Islands and then Tahiti. And each wave brought different groups of people with different ideas about religion, social structure, and so forth. Although we can't be absolutely sure because archaeology is very difficult in the islands because of the acidic soil which corrodes. Organic materials. We still have sites from around possibly the turn of the eras and maybe as late as the 800 AD that denote a sequence of migrations. The original peoples probably were kinship groups who migrated purposefully to this part of the Pacific. By the way, that's a very interesting story because. Most of the Polynesian migrations went eastward. Many believe that Polynesians originated in Southeast Asia and gradually island hopped eastward as far east as Easter Island and then moved southward toward New Zealand and then northward to Hawaii. Now, there are over 1,000 miles of ocean between Hawaii and the islands of the South Seas, as they were called. And so their migration northward diverted from their pattern eastward. And also, most scholars today believe that expeditions had to be purposefully outfitted for exploration and settlement. So this moved to the north, to Hawaii, was probably a purposeful one, and also instigated not so much by necessity or warfare, famine, hardships at home, but by the sense of adventure and also exploring new territories where they could settle. So the upshot then is that this was a an ingenious, innovative people who moved in new directions purposefully for the idea of setting up a new society. They brought with them ideas, and they also brought with them material culture. The material culture included things like plants and animals that they needed to subsist on, because they couldn't rely on the islands that they found to have the food that they needed. And also ideas about religion and social structure. I'm going on and on.
Was the I thought you were going to talk more about Hawaii, like the Hawaii social structure, actually.
Yeah.
But that was a good background introduction. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to stop you. so what was the Hawaii? How was this Hawaii social structure different before Westerners showed up?
Yeah. Okay. I think most scholars today believe two basic changes happened. The first group of Polynesians who arrived probably came, as I said, as kin groups and as a much more egalitarian society than the one that came later with the migration of Tahitians into the islands. Now, this is the course of several hundred years after the initial group probably settled Hawaii. The egalitarian nature of it revolves around the ideas about human beings and their place within the universe, and that is that humans are here to share the resources of the land, that people do not own things. There's no such thing as private property.
Start with that
people do not own things again. People do not own things, and in fact, the resources are shared and open to all. The egalitarian social structure revolved probably around the relations of production and who involve themselves in production. And that is, the principal division would be between men and women, men occupying certain economic niches, and women others. The egalitarian nature of that would be that one needed both to sustain oneself. And in fact, some believe Hawaii to have been originally a matrilineal or matriarchal society, because the principal means of economy was in agriculture. Although different parts of production were also divided among men and women. So even within agriculture, for example, men did certain chores within that sector and women did others. However, around probably 800 AD, with the migration of Tahitians to Hawaii, they brought in a much more stratified society of castes, mainly a royal caste and priestly castes, who imposed their will over the commoners or ordinary people. And probably the commoners were the original inhabitants of Hawaii, and probably the priestly and chiefly castes were those who were the recent immigrants from Tahiti.
Now, Westerners came in, did they at all take advantage of that structure, that there was a royal...
Sure. When Westerners arrived, they had familiarity, by the way, with other Polynesian societies in advance before arriving in Hawaii. Many of those Europeans actually studied those societies as scientists, both in terms of the natural resources and also the human resources, because they were also looking not only to map or to place on the globe the various exotic peoples and crops that they found, but also with the idea of an eventual colonization of those places for likely colonial products and also peoples. And the British, who were the principal Europeans who discovered and then came to settle Hawaii, came with the idea of indirect rule. And indirect rule, as conceived in most all of its colonies, that is Britain's colonies, involved rulership through the chiefly castes. And so they would largely keep the social structure intact, but utilize those who were at the top to govern the masses. And it was an economic model, of course. So What they did was to ingratiate themselves with the chiefly castes at first through goods, trade, and then also through ideas like religion, conversion to certain ideas, which would eliminate the priestly castes, which had a very strong hold over Hawaiian society about the time when Europeans arrived.
Now, I think just talking about perhaps a link between that those castes and then the mm-hmm. idea of paternalism, mm-hmm. would that make people more accepting of paternalism? Like, were the priestly castes, did they used to do things to take care of the people?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was, while highly stratified caste-wise, there was also reciprocation involved in the process, and that is that while the chiefs were separate, privileged, they also had responsibilities to the people, the commoners. And so the people produced for the chiefly castes, I mean, produced in terms of agricultural and ocean products, necessary for the sustenance, but also for the wealth of the chiefly castes. In turn, the chiefs were expected to protect, nurture, and nourish the people. Similarly, the priests had privileges, but they also were expected to nurture, support, and sustain the people religiously, psychologically. The reciprocation involved such that people who were unhappy with particular rulers were free to leave that group for another. And oftentimes that meant simply moving to a different side of the island, because each island had several chiefs in control of areas, or moving to another island entirely where chiefs were more distantly related. Wait, I never got to your question about how Europeans might have. So while there was that going on, that is a greater sense of reciprocation between the ruling caste and the people, the ordinary people, the Europeans introduced the idea of private property. And private property was a key instrument in the seduction and subjugation of the people. What that meant was that the land occupied by certain groups of kin groups principally, which were shared by all within the kin group, became the province of certain chiefs, kahuna, or the priests, and then ordinary people had smaller properties. And the division of the land called the Great Mahele took place in the mid-19th century. And that division then preserved most of the land for the ruling castes and a few of the land for the people, the vast majority of people. And with that control and the control over external trade by the ruling caste or class, they were able to accumulate wealth that separated themselves from the ordinary people. And so the process became much more a one-way process of exploitation rather than a reciprocation between the ruled and the rulers.
Now, what was plantar paternalism? I know this is jumping ahead, mm-hmm. but when there are, I don't know if you want to describe the first cane workers first. Maybe do that.
Well, yeah, okay. Let's see. So how does sugar production get to be a principal crop in Hawaii? Well, as I said, these Polynesians who arrived in Hawaii came with plants and animals, and among the plants was the sugar cane. So the Europeans, when they arrived in Hawaii, found Hawaiians cultivating sugar, which they were familiar with in other Southeast Asian and Asian countries already. And so Europeans saw that as a means by which to derive profits. Of course, longer standing was cane culture in the Caribbean islands, which Europeans deployed African slaves and then Asian coolies to cultivate. But in any case, in Hawaii, there were crops like pineapple, like sugarcane, that Europeans saw as a means by which to enrich themselves through trade. Similarly, actually, the ruling caste in Hawaii saw that as a means by which to trade for the kinds of products, the manufactured products that they coveted from the Asian and European trade. So there was that foundation for planter paternalism insofar as the ruling classes derive profits at the expense of the commoners. Now, interestingly, some of the first commercial sugar producers weren't Hawaiians, but Chinese who were brought over by Europeans who were already familiar with cane culture and also the production of large scale of sugar for exportation, probably from South China. And these established the first plantations and presses on the islands. And then Europeans came and took over essentially the production of sugar because they also had the means by which to transport that sugar, unlike the Chinese before them.
And when you say cane culture, just generally, what does that mean?
Well, cane culture involves large plots of land, first of all, as opposed to subsistence plots, which were devoted mainly to garden crops, the staple like taro for the Hawaiians or sweet potato. So it involved large acreages of land. It involved a single crop as opposed to several crops. Several crops, you see, insured against economic up and down swings and also against famine, which might result from, say, pests or other kinds of like rainfall and so forth, as insurance against that. But a single crop economy with that large acreages and large single crop, you needed an infrastructure of workers, plantation workers. And the plantation workers have to be a stable or relatively stable group as opposed to migrancy, which, say, in California, the crops there might be more amenable to migrancy. And so, large labor, stable labor force, meaning then a camp of agricultural laborers. Generally, of a particular gender, age, and then eventually ethnic group. By gender, we want those who will do certain kinds of tasks, who are able-bodied, of a certain age, so they wouldn't be infirm or old or too young to do the work. And efficient labor force, in other words, directed at the production of sugar. And then finally, you had to have the kind of machinery or technology involved in the production of sugar, and then the technology to ship or transport that sugar to the markets.
And then, when planters, when large groups, large companies started planting, what was their system of paternalism that they did, and sort of what was its purpose?
Okay, planter paternalism refers to a system of cane culture that involves a ruling class who presumes and assumes the role of a guardian for presumably inferior and children-like people. Planter paternalism involved things like houses, welfare, social activities, products like the stores and so forth that workers would need. The whole infrastructure of needs on the part of the workers were provided by the planting class or the ruling class. And that those within those bounds, then, the workers need to be grateful for that oversight, for that protection, and beneficence on the part of the planters. So it was conceived of as a reciprocal relationship, but as devised by those in control.
Did that create problems when labor movements began?
Well, the problems ensued right at the start, because I don't believe any human being, whether planter or worker, is mindless. That people, whether planter or worker, devise means by which to achieve their own ends, their own perceived welfare. And workers, like the planters, who devise the system of oppression and exploitation, resisted oppression and exploitation and sought to ensure their own futures economically and also the futures of eventually their families and children. And so, yes, planter paternalism, or the plantation system that sought to impose a particular structure, was always resisted, I believe, on the part of the workers. Now, the resistance took individual and then eventually collective forms. Individual resistance against control involved things like feigning illness so they didn't have to go out to work, running away from a particularly onerous plantation for a seemingly more benign one, breaking tools in the field, or even setting fire to the young cane before it was time for the harvest, and thereby destroying the crop. Those were some individual means by which workers resisted control. And then workers early on again realized that by joining together, whether as a class of workers or as an ethnic group of workers, they could achieve greater salary increases, better conditions on the plantation, the eradication of a brutal overseer or luna, and those other kinds of things.
Now, there were pretty much just five companies that were doing sugar for quite a while, weren't there? Could you describe the Big Five?
Okay. The Big Five was a monopoly. And as a monopoly, they had control of everything from the production end to the distribution end. And what I mean by that is that these companies controlled Hawaii's means and relations of production, from the production of the sugar to its manufacture to its transportation and shipping to the rest of the world. They involve banking, shipping, railroads, and agricultural land. Now, these five then control the economy of the islands, essentially, and they formed an interlocking directorship such that family members, and they were to a large degree individual family or collective family members, as heads of particular companies among the Big Five, would sit on other boards of directors of the Big Five. And so there was collusion among them as opposed to competition.
Did the fact that there were so few companies that were running so many things, did that have a negative effect on Hawaii's economy?
Oh, well, it depends on, how did it affect? Well, it affected the livelihood, for sure, of the islands, because they controlled all of production.
Could you say the Big Five affected?
Yeah, the Big Five controlled the economic life of the territory, which was, the territory after the 1900 Act of the U.S. annexing illegally an independent Hawaiian kingdom. So the Big Five control the economy for sure because of its monopoly over the production and distribution of capital and products, and also influence the political life of the territory because they control the economy. And in control of the economy, they were able to influence the structure and the inhabitants of the government.
And you talk about the different cultures of plantation workers that
Yeah,
came to
okay.
work.
All right. Yeah, earlier on I talked about the labor force as economic and as rational. That is on the basis of gender and then on the basis of ethnicity. Now, gender-wise, most of the plantations ran on men's labor. And so the vast majority of the early plantation workers, whether they were Hawaiians, indigenous Hawaiians, or Chinese, or Japanese, or Filipinos, were almost overwhelmingly men in composition. Now, the planters, along with the government, meaning at first the Hawaiian Kingdom and later the territorial government, sought to infuse the plantation workers with women. And that policy was a deliberate one, and I believe an economically rational one. The presence of women introduced onto the plantations had the effect of stabilizing the workforce. Men were less reliable in terms of stability than men with families. Men with families had a greater stake in the plantation that they were at. So instead of running away, they would be constrained to remain in one place. The idea also, which I believe false, but the planters believed, was that women moderated men's excessive behavior. By that, I mean men's excessive behavior revolved around violence or physicality, according to the planters, and antisocial behaviors like gambling and drinking, which reduced productivity. So the idea of women then was to moderate men's excesses. Now, as I say, I believe that to be a false representation, but anyway, that was part of the rationale for introducing women. Later on, with men and women organizing themselves into unions, which only became legal after 1900, by the way, when Hawaii became a territory of the U.S., when they began to organize themselves collectively, they pushed up wages, which were differential wages. Men got paid more than women, even though they might have been doing the same work, right? But they pushed up the wages of both men and women and the social benefits, including things like hospitals, health care for the children, schools, and so forth, which became increasingly expensive on the part of the plantations to run. The plantations counter then by employing women and children within the field, who then were paid less than the men and yet provided just as efficient and also just as productive labor. So it actually was a means by which to exploit the workers, that is the introduction of women and children onto the plantations, as well as to preserve the workforce. Now, the other kind of division besides gender was on the basis of ethnicity or ethnic group. And again, I believe that to have been a deliberate strategy on the part of the planters to divide and rule the workers. The idea of divide and rule was nurtured by the plantations insofar as they promoted ethnic culture. So while some white Americans might rail against the idea of Asiatic labor and also Asiatic religion, many of the planters promoted Asiatic migration and Asiatic religions to separate workers one from the other. So they would give days off, funds for the celebration of, say,
gonna get some more.
Okay. That's okay. Let's see. Okay, so planters would encourage various ethnic festivals for the Chinese, for the Japanese, which went against the grain of certain Americanists who sought to, quote, Americanize the territory, meaning to whiten the territory, not only with the physical presence of white Americans, but also with the cultural and religious apparatus of what the mainstream or majority group might have considered to have been American. In any case, so that encouragement then sought to divide Chinese from Japanese. They were also paid differentially, so the older ones, the Chinese in this case, were paid more than the Japanese. The Japanese were paid more than the Filipinos and so forth. And that way, the idea was so these workers would not unite across those ethnic divides. But unite they did, but it took some years after 1920 when the Chinese, Japanese and Filipinos actually joined together in a major strike. But
so I want to ask about the sort of like today, if you went to Hawaii today and mm-hmm. saw the huge mix of mm-hmm. cultures and that mm-hmm. sort of thing.
Did I drink yours?
What? I don't think so. Okay. I think you were drinking yours.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sort of how does that derive mm-hmm. from the culture situation today? How does it derive from the plantations?
Well, it seems really fascinating to me how the ruling class has turned things for their own benefit. I mean sort of the narrative of that historic past. The historic past really is one of colonization, expropriation, taking away native lands for particular kinds of ends, meaning economic and political ones, of the colonizers. And then to transpose that story into one of beneficence and uplift of an uncivilized group is one of those narratives that the colonizers brought vis-a-vis Hawaiians. The other mythology that has evolved from, again, oppression, exploitation, appropriation, is this myth of the multicultural Hawaii. Multicultural Hawaii is indeed a reality, but its origins was based principally in the division of labor and the antagonisms being promoted by that diversity of labor force. And so how a system of oppression becomes then a system of celebration of multiculturalism and diversity is a really interesting transition, and I believe the transition comes from the decline in the production of sugar to the rise of militarism or the presence of the military in Hawaii, along especially with the rise of tourism and the tourist industry. So under the guise of tourism and making Hawaii attractive to tourists, it actually began with a very racist drive on the part of the colonizers to swamp Hawaii with white people. And so there were these deliberate recruitment campaigns to lure white people from the U.S. continent to come as tourists at first and then eventual settlers in Hawaii, to lure them with the idea of paradise, meaning a physical paradise of temperate climates, abundance of products and food, and leisure, but also a kind of paradise in terms of race and race relations, where white is right, where white reigns supreme, but also an interaction of diverse cultures and peoples and a celebration of those cultures, which at root, again, under the plantation system, was a means by which to separate and exploit workers, and under this new regime of tourism becomes a means of celebration and attraction.
Are there other ways that the plantation culture influenced what Hawaiis today.
Oh, okay.
What are some other ways?
All right. Now, see, now on the part of the peoples themselves, there's an object in promoting those mythologies. I mean, the mythology of colonization and the mythology of multiculturalism. People themselves who are exploited under those systems, of course, do not want to speak or to conceive of that past as their exploitation, but would like to see that past as a process of inclusion by which diverse peoples came to not only mingle, but also to present the U.S. with an exemplary society when the U.S. is so riven by racism and race hatreds. Hawaii, by contrast, is like the omnipresent rainbows that form over Hawaii's skies, in which the diverse colors mingle and present a more scintillating display as a rainbow. But in any case, so then the people themselves who were formerly exploited have a role and a desire, in fact, to promote those kinds of mythologies. Now, underneath it, however, we have in Hawaii what's called ethnic jokes. And ethnic jokes are revealing of particular fissures in that society. The fissures involve things like the Portuguese are the brunt of ethnic jokes in Hawaii. And a reason for that is because the Portuguese were, to a large degree, the overseer or luna class on the plantation. They were the ones who supervised the Asian and Pacific Islander workers, and they were the ones who were neither white, meaning Anglo-white, at the top of the structure, nor of the bottom. They were in the middle. And as middle people who aspired perhaps toward the top but could never get there, and who perhaps despised the bottom because they had certain privileges, they were the bulk of the kind of joke that on the continent they have Polish jokes about. That is, Portuguese then are dirty, stupid, incompetent, and so forth within that lexicon of jokes. Now, the other kind of thing, of course, is that we have particular ethnic groups about Chinese, Japanese, Filipinos, Haoles, or white people. And those kinds of humor bespeak, I think, a people's deeply felt feelings about the other group, which aren't all that celebratory, you know, they're not so wonderful because they cut at particular stereotypes and prejudices against particular groups. But in any case,
Could you say they cut at
they
out? Hey, it's not funny. Stupid truck. Okay, go ahead. They cut it.
well, ethnic jokes and ethnic humor in Hawaii gain, I think, a lot of their comedy by reducing the humanity of another group of people. And they bespeak widely held prejudices or stereotypes about particular groups of people. And I think that still remains in Hawaii a clear sort of distinction of the divisions, despite the reality of a great deal of intermarriage between peoples and, on the whole, very amicable relations among different groups of people.
So there are still, though, in Hawaii, say there's Chinatown or whatever, in different areas of town where people would live, like they who have grown up in different cultures, or have they sort of conglomerated?
Yeah, well, the residential segregation pattern began with the plantations. And by the way, on the plantations, certain groups were located physically in certain camps. So, for example, I grew up in Aiea Plantation, and the camp that I grew up in was largely Japanese, but also some Chinese and Portuguese. Whereas the Filipino camp was down at the bottom of the plantation physically, where it was hotter and less comfortable for the people to live. So there were those physical kinds of segregations, that is, residential segregations that paralleled the occupational segregation or hierarchies. And in the rest of the, in the urban centers, there would also be these residential segregations based principally on economic or class standing. So I remember